Our topic this morning is civil disobedience versus faithful obedience. You know, in the country in which we live, civil disobedience has a proud history. It's about nonviolently disobeying civil law in order to make a point, in order to change civil law. So the question that I want to put to you is that what Christians are to be about? In regard to civil law, Christians are indeed to make a point, and we see that in 1 Peter. But what is the point? Is it to change civil law? In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12, Peter says, "Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation." So here's the idea. People in a worldly society who are trying to be righteous, trying to live holy lives, trying to live in accordance with God's will, are going to be targets for fault finding. People are going to want to point out the things that they've done. How many times have you heard somebody of the world say, "Well, those Christians are just a bunch of hypocrites"? And of course, that's their excuse for not bringing their own lives into conformity with the will of God. But if people are going to be looking for an opportunity to find fault, Peter is admonishing Christians. Behave as you ought. Have your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Peter's going to make several applications of this principle, but he's going to make an application specifically with regard to the laws of the country in which we live. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 and 14, Peter says, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men." Do right. Silence the ignorance of those who would find fault. So what is the point that Christians are trying to make in regard to civil law? Not that the law is unfair. It may be. Not that the law is unjust. It might be. Not the law that the law needs to be changed. That's possible. But the point Christians are to be making is rather this. Don't give people a reason for finding fault with you. Do the right thing. This is really the point in 1 Peter, the 4th chapter, in verses 15 and 16. "Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or evildoer or a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. If you suffer, let it be because you did the right thing, not because you did the wrong thing." There's some exemplary attitudes in the Bible toward political authority. I want to talk with you about two of them. First one that always comes to my mind is Daniel. In Daniel, the first chapter, Nebuchadnezzar has come to Judah and he has taken away the king and he's taken treasures out of the temple. And not only that, but he also tells the chief of his officers, a man named Aspenaz, to round up some of the young men of Judah, men of noble families, men of the royal household even. And he wants to take these young men back to Babylon, where he can put them in his service. He can train them for service in his court. We're not told what Daniel's attitude was about being taken to Babylon. You could imagine, possibly, conceivably, a young man thinking, "Oh boy, I get to go to Babylon." Or you could imagine a young man saying, "This is not fair. I'm being taken away from my family, from my friends, from my country." If I were to guess, I would suspect it was more the latter than the former. But we really don't know. What we do know was it wasn't his choice. He was taken to Babylon, and that was the will of the king. Daniel could have had a chip on his shoulder about that. "I'm not going to comply with anything. I'm going to resent this." Daniel made up his mind in one regard. In verse 8, it says, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself. It says he made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. The New American Standard goes on to say, so he sought permission from the commander of the officials, that he might not defile himself. You may notice, if you have the New American Standard or if you're looking at the screen, the word permission there is in italics, which tells you the translators have added that word. I'm not real fond of that particular addition by the translators, because if you just read that phrase by itself, it might leave you with the impression Daniel's thinking, well, if they'll give me permission not to defile myself, then I won't defile myself. But Daniel, in verse 8, it said he had made up his mind that he was not going to defile himself. And so if we read this in if we read this without that word in parentheses, it's just this: Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice or with the wine which he drank, so he sought from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. He's going to work through the authorities to do what he can in a compliant way, but he's made up his mind. He is not going to defile himself. Now, God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, "I am afraid." You know, oftentimes when we're dealing with a civil servant and we find that a civil servant is not wanting to be very helpful or compliant or make some allowance that really could be made, the problem is this is a person who's reporting to somebody else. And the person is just concerned about his own standing with his superiors or her superiors. That's the situation here. The commander of the officials said to Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. But why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age?" In other words, he's responsible for Daniel and Daniel's friends from Judah. And if they don't turn out as well as the others, this man, he could pay, well, it says, with his life. He says, "You would make me forfeit my head to the king." So Daniel said to the overseer from whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. And then at the end of verse 13, deal with your servants according to what you see. Give us a chance." What you see in Daniel's attitude here is not a chip on the shoulder attitude. He's resolved to do the right thing. But he conducts himself in such a way that you could say it's gracious, and he wins favor. And the Lord gives him favor with the authorities. Consider the Apostle Paul. He conducted himself in such a way that he was given leave to speak after being arrested and before being hauled off to jail. This is in Acts, the 21st chapter, and Paul has gone into the temple, and he's been accused of taking a Gentile into the temple. And so there's been a tumult, and the Jews have assaulted him, perhaps would have killed him, until the Roman soldiers came in and took control of the situation. And as they're hauling Paul off, Paul asks permission to speak to the people. Now, how often does it happen when you get arrested before you're hauled off to jail that you're able to ask, "Hey, officer, can I say a few things to the people standing around here first?" Of course, I'm sure that most of you don't very often get arrested and would encourage you not to do so. But it speaks of the situation, the relationship here, the conduct of Paul, that he conducted himself in such a manner that he was given that allowance. In Acts chapter 21 and verse 39, Paul said, "I'm a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand, and when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect. Later on, Paul is in the custody of Felix. And Felix has an interesting idea. In Acts chapter 24, verse 26, at the same time, too, Felix was hoping, that money would be given him by Paul. Why would he want money from Paul? Well, obviously, that's if you want to be let go, give me money. In other words, it's really kind of a subtle form of extortion. And so he used to send for Paul quite often and converse with him. Here's Paul, who is being held in custody by a government official who is trying to extort money from Paul. We don't hear a word about Paul protesting the extortion. What we do hear is that Paul reasoned with him concerning righteousness and self-control and judgment to come. No record that he protested what amounted to extortion. Paul had remarkable influence with his captors. When he is a prisoner and sailing to Rome, and he is in custody of a centurion named Julius. Verse 3 of Acts 27 says, the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. Here along the journey en route to Rome, sure, Paul, you can take some time and go see your friends here in this city. In verse 9, they've come to the island of Crete. And when considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. What kind of a prisoner has standing to talk to his captors about the jeopardy that they might be in if they continue the voyage? And the fact is, in this particular instance, the centurion gave more heed to the owner of the ship than he did to Paul and Paul's concerns. But it's interesting that he considered Paul's concerns at all. And then later on, in verse 42, when they have a shipwreck, and the soldier's plan was to kill the prisoners so that none of them would swim away and escape, the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention. You see, Paul conducting himself in such a way that he wins the favor of the people who are his captors. He did avail himself of his rights under the law. In Acts, the 22nd chapter, after he'd been arrested in the temple and taken into custody, and they stretched him out with thongs in verse 25, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? And that man reported it to the chief captain, Claudius Lysias. Claudius Lysias was very upset. He was afraid when he realized how he was mishandling the situation because Paul was a Roman citizen. And so Paul availed himself of his rights under the law. And later on in Acts 25th chapter and verse 11, when he's in custody under Festus, and Festus is wanting to win favor with the Jews, do the Jews a favor. And so he proposes to Paul, but you know, the Jews want me to bring you to them. How about we take you down, let you talk with them again? And Paul knew what the Jews were up to. And so he wasn't going to do that. And he didn't have to. He said, if I then am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Paul even on one occasion called people who had him in custody into account when they had misbehaved. In Acts chapter 16 and verse 37, after Paul and Silas had been arrested in Philippi, and then messengers had been sent to say, okay, you can go, we'll release you. Paul said to them, they've beaten us in public without trial, men who are Romans and have thrown us into prison, and now they're sending us away secretly? No, indeed. Let them come themselves and bring us out. But what you see in all of this is not somebody who is defiant with respect to the political authorities. What you see is somebody who does use the rights that he has. He's going to do the right thing, and he's going to talk about the things of God. His primary concern is not to get laws changed and to get laws to be the way he would prefer them to be. What you see in Paul, and what you see especially in the example of Daniel, is a quiet, uncompromising obedience to God. Let's go back to Daniel. In Daniel, the sixth chapter, Daniel is now in his 80s at the least. He was a young man when he was carried away to Babylon. Now, decades later, when he is in his 80s, he is serving as a high official in the administration of the Persian king. And he's done so well that he has some rivals who are jealous of him, and they would like to kind of impede his rise and maybe get some opportunity to have that status themselves. But they realize the only way they can get Daniel in trouble is if they can somehow bring the law of the land into conflict with the law of Daniel's God, because they know what Daniel will do. And so they go to the king, and they propose that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction. This is in verse 7, an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. And the king doesn't see what they're up to, and he goes along with that. So verse 10 says, now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now, his roof chamber, in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. He's not doing this to make a scene. He's not doing this to make a point about Persian law and to get laws changed. But there is a clear priority in Daniel's mind. The will of God supersedes the will of any king. Notice he conducted himself, though, in such a way that even the king was for him. When the king realizes what Daniel's rivals were up to and Daniel's in trouble, the king can't change it. The law of the Medes and Persians was such that not even the king himself could change the law once it had been made and his seal had been put to it. But when Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, the king had a very sleepless night worrying about Daniel's condition, and early the next morning he's there wanting to make sure or find out, has Daniel survived the night? And he was very grateful when he found out that Daniel had. Daniel conducted himself in such a way that even the king was for him. You think about these attitudes, and then let's talk about the time in which we are here for just a minute. We're not choosing to stay at home today because we respect political authority more than we respect God's authority. The fact is, here in Pennsylvania, what they are saying counts religious organizations as essential. The fact is, as things are in Pennsylvania, we could assemble if we could realistically practice social distancing, and we would not run afoul of anything, that any law that's been put forward. There might be some officer or some representative of government who might be perturbed or find fault, but so be it. We're choosing to stay home to avoid making someone sick. It's really the same thing as when you have a stomach bug and you know you're probably still contagious, but you've taken enough Imodium or whatever you take, Pepto-Bismol, that you think you've got things under control, and you think, you know, I could probably drive down to the church building and I could sit in the back pew and I could probably get through it and get home. But you choose not to because you know you could spread it. You don't want to give anybody else this stomach bug. And we're doing that collectively, really, all of us, in this occasion. But I pray that what we're going through right now is short term, that is acute and not chronic, that it's not an ongoing thing. I pray to God that this will pass quickly. I pray God's will be done. God's got something in mind here, and I pray God's will be done. His will is good and right. But if it be His will, I do pray that this would pass quickly. However, what if, just consider for a moment, what if this is not an acute situation? What if this is the new normal? What if there is no vaccine coming down the pipe? What if, as a matter of fact, we just go through a period of years where mankind is subject to the ravaging of this disease? You know, we live in unusual times. If you look over the course of the history of the world, it's not been unusual at all that there was one disease or another that was ravaging mankind. We have diseases, we have cancer, and we don't entirely understand why someone gets cancer. We don't understand as much about that as we would like to. We have STDs, but that's really a behavior-related kind of thing. We have colds that can be a nuisance, and we have flu, which can be deadly. But really, compared to past times in history, we don't have the number of diseases that you get just by going out in public. In past times in history, there were a number of diseases just by going about life's activities to which you could be exposed and die. Measles is one. Smallpox is another. Consider measles. 7 to 8 million children are thought to have died from measles every year. 7 to 8 million children every year before the vaccine came along for measles. Smallpox. The risk of death if you got smallpox was about 30%. In 18th century Europe, it's estimated that 400,000 people per year died from smallpox. This is another disease I want to mention to you that's usually spread between people by direct contact or through the air. It may also be spread by contaminated objects. Some people carry this disease without having symptoms, but can still spread the disease to others. Does that sound familiar? But I'm not talking about the coronavirus or COVID-19. That's diphtheria. In the 1920s, in the United States alone, it's estimated that between 13 and 15,000 deaths a year occur as a result of diphtheria. Now, somebody may say, well, we're a little over half of that in number of deaths already after 2 or 3 months in the United States with this COVID-19. And that's true. And they may say, and we may have many, many more. And that's true. But you have to keep in mind that the population in 1925, when you had 13 to 15,000 people dying each year from diphtheria, the population of the United States was only a third of what it is now. So in percentages, this was a very significant thing. So you look over the course of history, and it's not been unusual in prior ages that there were just things you got as you went about life's activities. People got sick. People died. What if that's the situation that we're facing? I don't know. I pray that it's not. Right now, we're acting with the view that this is an acute thing. It's a temporary thing, and we're trying to do what we can to get past it. But if this becomes the norm, if this becomes the way of life, it will become the way of life. And we'll go about our activities, and we will serve God, and we will assemble, and we will worship God. There's one other thought that I want to leave you with before I close. And that is, I have never in my lifetime experienced something like what we're seeing right now. 9/11 was huge. 9/11 affected the world, but it affected the world in limited ways. Mainly it affected travel. And yes, security became more intense in public areas, in public buildings, that kind of thing. But for much of our lives, it really didn't affect us, other than maybe psychologically. But this is something that is largely shutting down the entire world. I'm not saying this is unprecedented in human history, but it's unprecedented in my history. And it's in such times as this that history can change dramatically, suddenly. If you think back to 1914, there was a duke from Austria who was visiting Sarajevo, and there were some assassins who tried to kill him and failed. Later the same day, his motorcade, by chance, took a wrong turn down the street. And lo and behold, by chance, one of the would-be assassins happened to be standing on that street and had a second opportunity and killed that duke. Now, the people of Austria didn't react particularly much. Apparently, they didn't think it was all that big a deal. But the political wheels began to turn, and it wasn't long before World War I, and the world changed. Who saw it coming? And then you think to a more recent event. You think about the 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall. When those of you who are my age, you remember growing up in a time when we thought of East Europe and West Europe. West Europe was where people lived who were free, and they could travel all over the world. And East Europe, countries like Poland and Romania and Moldova and East Germany and Hungary and Czechoslovakia, those people lived behind the Iron Curtain. And they were not free, and they were impoverished. And we felt bad for them, but we couldn't do anything about it. And they could not leave to come to the West. They could travel amongst their own countries. Those countries that I mentioned were part of the Warsaw Pact. They were not technically part of the Soviet Union, but they were part of the Soviet bloc. And so they were under that authoritarian, totalitarian, communist control. And then what happened? Well, Lech Walesa came along in Poland and the Solidarity Movement. And that made such waves that people in some of those other Soviet bloc countries started having thoughts about escaping and thoughts about freedom. And then in Hungary, they took down the electrified fence in places along the border with Austria. And then there were some Germans, East Germans, from behind the Iron Curtain, who could travel to another Iron Curtain country in Hungary. And they were there on vacation, and they saw their opportunity, and 900 of them rushed the border and went across into Austria. And from there, they could get to West Germany. And when that happened, other people were emboldened, and people started flowing out of East Germany to other Iron Curtains, countries behind the Iron Curtain, where they could find an opening in the border and get to the West and get to West Germany. And as the West German political officials were trying to manage all of this in East Germany, they made some decisions, and then they threw some guy out in front of the cameras to have a press conference, and he got caught flat-footed, and some reporter asked him a question, and he answered it off the cuff and without really knowing what he was saying, and said something that effectively said, we're going to take down the wall. And lo and behold, everybody said, okay, and boom, they went and overwhelmed the guards, and the wall came down, and East Germany was no more in short order, and East Europe was no longer behind the Iron Curtain, and the world changed, and for the better, I would think. What I'm saying is, the 21st century is known as the American century, but the United States of America is not forever. I don't know what God has in mind, but I know that what we're going through right now is the kind of thing that can begin a cavalcade of events. And the freedoms that you and I have enjoyed, and the protections that we've enjoyed and cherished under the Constitution of the United States, could go away. What are we going to do as Christians? Are we going to rail about the laws and say, this is not fair? Are we going to practice civil disobedience? Are we going to march in the streets? Or are we going to practice faithful obedience to God, quietly determined to do what is right, understanding that ultimately God is in control, and our loyalty is to him and not to the civil authorities? Daniel established his priorities as a young man, and he lived by them as an old man. So the question that we need to each ask ourselves, what priorities have we established? What priorities have you established? And what priorities are we establishing? It's kind of hard after you get into the hard times to establish new loyalty to God and new priorities. We need to put those priorities in place now. And if hard times come and we lose some of our freedoms, let's go on doing the right thing. We may suffer for it. That's what Peter says. Don't suffer for being an evildoer. But if you suffer